Is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandi Spergotta for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Ariana Davis is titled, Maria Hinojosa. I was the first Latina in every newsroom I ever worked in. Longtime NPR listeners are familiar with her signature introduction. I'm Maria Hinojosa, pronounced in Spanish, of course. Because for more than 25 years on the radio, journalist Maria Hinojosa has always been her most authentic self. It's that subtle but unwavering commitment to reporting the news while maintaining her identity that's often led me to argue Hinojosa doesn't get enough credit for her contributions to American journalism. Since kicking off her career on NPR in 1985 and then founding the program Latino USA in 1992, one of the first radio shows dedicated to the Latinx community, the Mexican-American Chicago native has gone on to build the kind of legacy journalists like myself can only dream of. Through the years, she racked up accolades as she became the clear-headed guiding voice for Latinos across the country through multiple presidencies, immigration policies, and community crises, while also offering up introspective interviews with everyone from Pitbull to AOC. In 2010, Hinojosa founded and became the president and CEO of Futuro Media Group, a multimedia journalism platform that now produces Latino USA, as well as several other NPR and PBS programs. Now she's telling her own narrative, bringing her signature candor and knack for storytelling, to Once I Was You, a memoir of love and hate in a torn America. In this memoir, Hinojosa takes us along her journey as a Mexican immigrant raised in Chicago, who went on to become an activist, wife, and mother. She beautifully renders stories of her personal life, falling in love with her Dominican-American painter husband, balancing her rise as a hard-hitting journalist with raising two children, while weaving in the important historical context of immigration and policy during her lifetime. By the end, I was left reflecting on not just my own identity as a Latina, but also my responsibility to my community, and wondering what history Hinojosa might be telling 25 years from now. I sat down with Hinojosa for a Zoom from my apartment in Queens, New York, to hers in Harlem, to talk about Latina Dad, her work, and why she's not slowing down anytime soon. I couldn't get enough of your book, and as a Latina and a journalist myself, this is such an honor. But before we dive in, how are you doing? You were open on social media about what it was like having COVID-19. You know, I think a lot about my denial of getting sick. After you have COVID, there is definitely a PTSD thing that happens. You find yourself suddenly going back to the bad moments, and it happens to me all the time. Today it happened because I took a walk with my dog. It reminded me that the first thing I could do after testing negative, after a month of fever, was to just walk slowly with my dog for an hour. And when I got it, it was such a different time. There were no tests available. What I remember most is the horrible fever and body aches, and the guilt that I knew I likely infected my husband, though we never knew for sure. He didn't have the typical symptoms, so back then he wouldn't have qualified to get a test. I also think a lot about many people I've lost. Friends of my husband in the Dominican Republic, people we know in Mexico, people I know in Chicago, people in Texas. It slowed down a little, but for so long it was basically a death every week, every 2 weeks. And now I do think of myself as a survivor. In terms of history, I will now say I am a survivor of a pandemic. What saved me was my meditation, my dog, my family, and boxing. I dance and I box. That's how I've survived, and that's how I continue to survive. But this is not normal. We cannot normalize what's happening now. I've had so many conversations over the last few months with Latinos about their role in the Black Lives Matter movement. My father is Black and my mother is Puerto Rican, so this is a dialogue I've been having my entire life, the fact that many Latinos are also black, but there's a lot of denial still happening that stems from our complicated history. Do you think our community is making progress here? The reason why we have anti-immigrant sentiment is because we have anti-black sentiment. We need to begin by understanding that immigration is part of this whole story, and that the movement for black lives is tied to a movement to celebrate immigrant lives, which is tied to a movement to celebrate Latino and Latina lives, because we are all ASI, we're all the target. My identification with black America is very real. I grew up on the south side of Chicago, so my understanding of race was based on experiencing and living through the civil rights era. The Black Panthers were in my neighborhood. My madrina, godmother, is an African-American woman and like my spiritual guide. I would not be who I was if it wasn't for Black America. But not everyone grew up with that experience, and the racism within Latinos and Latinas, we have to look at it. We have to call it out. It's a good thing that it's happening now so we can point to it. It's leading to a lot of difficult conversations, and so be it. But also, people like you, being biracial, you're like the epitome of the hope. I know it's not easy. Identity is complicated. How we identify is part of the social construct. For instance, I identify a lot with where I choose to live. I live in Harlem, New York. My husband is Dominican. I'm raising my kids as Dominimex. That's what we call them, Dominimex. But for example, my husband also identifies as black. So my daughter identifies as Afro-Latina, while not necessarily presenting that way, which some who might not know any better might have an issue with. But she identifies that way. The younger generation is making a choice. Am I standing with Black Lives Matter or not? And I think many of us, but especially the younger generations, are finally making the choice. No, no, no. Estamos aquí. We're here. And abuelita, por favor, no usas esas palabras. Please don't use those words. I love the anecdote in your book where you're a young radio reporter introducing yourself on the air for the first time, and you have this internal moment of, do I pronounce my name in Spanish or more Anglo-friendly? And you decide to pronounce it in Spanish. How did you find the bravery to be who you were in that moment and continue to do so? I never saw my mother or father change who they were in order to fit in. My father spoke with a thick Mexican accent forever. He helped to create the cochlear implant. He was a genius, but he had a very thick Mexican accent in his English. My mother never finished high school, but she was a celebrated social worker in the city of Chicago. Neither ever changed who they were, so I think that kind of lays a root in you. I was the first Latina in every newsroom I ever worked in. This particular moment happened to be at NPR, so I was like, if they're going to see me a little bit different, well, then I'm going to be that. I'm always just trying to be me, and I'm trying to have you understand that me being a full Latina is part of our full American reality. But don't get me wrong, it can be hard and confusing, and I dealt with a lot of imposter syndrome, which I talk about a lot in the book. But that's why I write about it, because I want to encourage people that when it happens, don't let it take you down. You are not an imposter. Please fight against that feeling. After 25 years, what keeps you motivated to keep telling these stories and to continue to be a voice of our community? Well, thank you for calling me that. I never saw myself as that. Since I created Futuro Media and created my own staff and my own newsroom, we've been very thoughtful about how we expand on what we do best, which is telling stories from this particular perspective. What keeps me motivated is, for example, if I look at my phone, I have texts from a young Honduran man who is a refugee, who is in a desperate situation about to leave his country for the fourth time. They've given him residency in Mexico, but will they actually give it to him? I'm also in touch with a woman who is here in New York with her child, who they tried to take away from her, who is blind. Now the question is, how are you going to reunite a mother with a blind child? So I'm in touch with people like that every single day. Those are the stories that keep needing to be told. And I've been doing this so long, and I'm going to be real crass here, but because I've won most of the awards that I've wanted to win, I don't have to prove anything to anybody. I don't have to prove that I'm an objective journalist. My career stands for itself. So my heart is very open, and I want to focus on the human elements. Of course, as I get older, some days I want to just go sit by a lake and read fabulous novels and work out all day. But I know I could only do that for so long. As I say in the book, very early on I understood that privilege means responsibility. So I take that very seriously in terms of my journalism and in terms of being a media entrepreneur. When I teach, I ask my students the first day of class, what is your craziest, wildest, most insane dream? Mine was always to act in a Hollywood film. I still hope to actually do a one-woman show. That's a dream. We'll see. I'm pushing myself to think out of bounds because I want to role model that for the younger generation. It's never too late, and I'm never giving up. The cool thing about getting older, you don't give a shit. It's very freeing. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, What is Cultural Appropriation and How Can You Avoid It? Examples of cultural appropriation are everywhere you look in pop culture, fashion, and even food. The is it appropriation or appreciation question in particular has sprouted annually ahead of Halloween costume season in recent years. Yet there's no true consensus on the definition of cultural appropriation and how serious of an offense it is, nor on who gets to act as judge and juror when it comes to the latter. While the term itself is decades old, it became more widely known in 2013. The idea of cultural appropriation certainly started to hit the mainstream with Miley Cyrus and twerking, says Erica Niwa, assistant professor of psychology at Brooklyn College, who has studied how culture impacts ethnic and racial identity. Cyrus sparked a tidal wave of online conversation over the fact that she lifted, without credit, her dance style from the black bounce music scene in New Orleans, a culture that millions of her fans had never heard of, for her own great commercial and financial reward. The debate resurfaced often over that following year as Cyrus's pop music peer Katy Perry took flack for appropriation gaffes that included performing in Japanese geisha garb, donning cornrow braids with gelled-down baby hair, while singing about getting our nails did all Japanesey in her This Is How We Do video, and dressing like an Egyptian queen in the clip for Dark Horse, which also drew accusations of anti-Muslim blasphemy for a since-deleted scene. Few could have predicted then that society was only just at the dawn of an ongoing dialogue, one that now surges anew on social media daily. Perry's annoyed response to her controversies at the time reflected how some people still feel today whenever an instance of cultural borrowing is deemed out of pocket. I guess I'll just stick to baseball and hot dogs and that's it, she said in a 2014 Rolling Stone profile, adding, I can't appreciate a culture. I guess like everybody has to stay in their lane. I don't know. The thing is, most people don't 100% know what's acceptable and what's not. And there are layers. Not every instance of cultural appropriation is worthy of being canceled, if such a phenomenon even exists. And as white female pop stars, Cyrus and Perry were more likely to garner attention for their problematic album promotions. But really, they were just two stars in a broad galaxy of people who participate in complex intercultural borrowing. Here's a brief explanation of what cultural appropriation is, why it's so complicated, and a few expert-suggested ways to avoid crossing a line. First things first, what is cultural appropriation? The term cultural appropriation has been defined as the taking from a culture that is not one's own of intellectual property, cultural expressions or artifacts, history, and ways of knowledge. The editors of Borrowed Power, a collection of essays focused on indigenous cultures, wrote back in 1997. The sentences that follow pose questions people still struggle to answer more than 20 years later. This simple description bristles with uncertainty. What do we mean by taking? What values and concerns are implicated in the process of appropriation? And how, if at all, should we respond? Niwa elaborates that those things being taken or appropriated as one's own include ideas, dress, food, artifacts, history, or spiritual practices, such as yoga and the language around things like tantric sex. Though yoga and tantric sex are rooted in ancient Indian traditions, the U.S. culture surrounding the former is so overwhelmingly white that some consider it a form of appropriation. And no, as this article explains, this does not mean you can't practice yoga if you're not of South Asian descent. In rare instances, appropriation has entailed borrowing an entire racial identity, as two white women famously did in recent years. Rachel Dolezal, who for years altered her appearance to pose as a black woman, and Jessica Krug, a white professor who confessed to inventing a false Afro-Latina persona for professional gain. While widely discussing appropriation may be fairly new, the act itself is not. The practice of repurposing culture is as old as culture itself, and America has been making other cultures appropriate to its amusement and ambition since the very beginning. Lauren Michelle Jackson writes in White Negroes, When Cornrows Were in Vogue, and Other Thoughts on Cultural Appropriation. Pointing out examples in jazz, hip-hop, sports team names like the Redskins and Braves, and slang that came from black and gay subcultures, Jackson writes that to try and keep track would be an exhausting exercise in futility. Appropriation is everywhere and is also inevitable, she writes. If you've noticed that the majority of headline-making visual examples seem to focus on women, you're right. The conversation primarily centers on women, says Mia Moody Ramirez, PhD, professor and chair of the Baylor University Department of Journalism, Public Relations, and New Media. Cultural appropriation is often about people stealing things they deem beautiful or unique. It may be overgeneralizing, but those are more often things traditionally worn by women. Examples include bindis, kimonos, or the Chinese kopapo-style dress that incited a deeply thorny debate after Twitter eviscerated a white high school student who wore one to prom. We see appropriations iterated everywhere across social media, where the lion's share of fiery debate on the topic occurs, though it's not solely white people who borrow. Black pop stars such as Nicki Minaj and Beyonce, for instance, have respectively sparked controversy for lifting Asian and Indian cultures. Situations like that are a little more complicated, Niwa says, because you're talking about two different cultural groups where the power differential isn't as obvious. And ultimately, Niwa and Ramirez Moody agree, determining how problematic a cultural appropriation moment is, and not every instance is worthy of uproar, is all about power. It's important to remember that the give and take of cross-cultural borrowing doesn't happen on a level playing field. As actress Amandla Stenberg pointed out in a viral 2015 video, many non-black Americans who heavily borrow from black culture for clout or career advancement don't always support actual black Americans in their lived experiences of structural racism and violence at the hands of police. What would America be like if we loved black people as much as we love black culture, Stenberg says in summary. Are you imitating a culture that has a history of oppression, marginalization, exploitation? Are you benefiting from that borrowing, says Niwa? And when you're tired or over it, or it's November 1st, can you take it off? Because there's inherently power and privilege in that. Educate yourself on the cultures you're drawing from. If you're applying a bindi and you're not of Indian descent, would you be able to say that you know the traditional meanings behind the symbol? Are you wearing a kyako as a fashion statement, yet remaining silent when you hear anti-Chinese sentiment during the COVID-19 pandemic? Being somewhat informed about the accessory or garment's cultural significance is ideal. Ask yourself, are you sexualizing the sacred? Whether it's picking an outfit for the club or devising a sexy fill-in-the-blank Halloween costume, Moody Ramirez says another reason to learn more about the culture or cultural item you're repurposing is so you'll know whether the item is sacred to the community it comes from. For example, Native American headdresses or war bonnets hold deep meanings that vary from tribe to tribe, but feathers were often earned through acts of bravery and typically worn by elder men. When Karlie Kloss walked the Victoria's Secret's catwalk wearing a replica Native American-style headdress, lingerie, and befringed high heels in 2012, the corporation had to issue an apology shortly after. We have gone through the atrocities to survive and ensure our way of life continues, Navajo Nation spokesman Ernie Za told USA Today. Any mockery, whether it's Halloween, Victoria's Secret, they are spitting on us. They are spitting on our culture, and it's upsetting. Ultimately, it's most important to remember that if you're not a member of the culture that is being borrowed from, you are not best qualified to weigh in on whether an instance of appropriation is or is not offensive. You can't really walk in a person from another culture's shoes, and that's another reason people get offended, says Moody Ramirez. For instance, she says, they might say, well, you're dressing up like a black person, but then when you go home, you can take the costume off. Whereas a black person can never change their skin color and can't avoid systemic racism and the other pressures that come with it. Finally, when it comes to cultural appropriation in general, keep the conversation constructive. Calling out perceived violations on a case-by-case basis has yet to resolve the conversation, particularly when one's aim is to humiliate and not inform. In its proliferation, the term cultural appropriation has become charged. Conversations about it are radioactive, Refinery 29's Connie Wang writes, reflecting on covering a decade's worth of news on the topic. She goes on to write, "The do-or-die way we talk about cultural appropriation has somehow made it easier to punish those who have the most to learn and reward those who know just the bare minimum." That said, the solution isn't to let exploitive appropriation go unchecked, especially when it's being used to sell something, be it music, clothes, or sponsored Instagram posts. When done well, there's value in difficult conversations that can help us understand each other better. Katy Perry shared her own process of realizing her past mistakes in a 2017 interview with activist and Pod Save the People host DeRay Mickison, including her misappropriation of traditionally black hairstyles and her geisha girl outfit. "I listened and I heard and I didn't know, and I won't ever understand some of those things because of who I am. But I can't educate myself, and that's what I'm trying to do along the way," Perry said. Instead of railing against one musician or reality star and the off-screen creative team they might have dreamed up their look with, it might be more helpful to examine the larger systems that reward celebrities who cherry-pick from another culture for artistic and monetary profit, and consider how we all participate in it. Though on the celebrities' part, hiring a diverse creative team wouldn't hurt. And owning up to our participation may require some tough exchanges, but it's important to try to engage with as little defensiveness or rancor as possible, another challenge in what's been called the call-out culture of the internet. The question of appropriation versus appreciation is a question of intent, Niwa says. Online conflicts tend to arise when someone's good intentions make a harmful impact. On the one hand, you've got to have the strength of character to be able to hear when you've hurt somebody's feelings, even if you didn't mean to, she continues, so that we can be better. But if you're not purposely hurting somebody, there has to be some capacity for dialogue. If you're willing to change and grow, then you can change and grow. Our next article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled, "So What's the Difference Between Race and Ethnicity?" What are you? Many of us are often posed with this awkward question when it comes to how we identify, and it's hard to know how to answer. Is the person asking you to explain your race or your ethnicity, or maybe even both? And then there's another question. What is the difference between race and ethnicity anyway? To find some clarification and better understand the significance of each of these two terms, we consulted Jennifer DeVere Brody, Stanford University's director of the Center for Comparative Studies on Race and Ethnicity. When looking at how society, scholars, and the government define the words, the university explains, there is little agreement on core distinctions between race and ethnicity. Brody herself uses the word complicated when asked about how we can genuinely understand race and ethnicity, explaining that over the years, law, medicine, and common sense have blurred their true meanings. As Toni Morrison would have said, race and ethnicity are metaphorical terms. They're concepts that get used every day by different kinds of people to understand difference in the world, Brody says. Aha, so essentially the difference between race and ethnicity is complicated indeed. But with a little help from Brody, we broke it down below. How do you define race? In society, race is often used to define someone by their skin color, as well as other physical, social, and biological attributes. For example, the U.S. Census defines race as a person's self-identification with one or more social groups. These personal identifiers are the words you most often see when you're completing official paperwork and are asked to check the box of your respective race. So, when considering what the different types of races are, the options are usually white, Black or African American, Asian, American Indian, Alaska Native, Native Hawaiian, and other Pacific Islander. If you want a more official definition, here's what the Encyclopedia Britannica has to say. The idea that the human species is divided into distinct groups on the basis of inherited physical and behavioral differences. Genetic studies in the late 20th century refuted the existence of biogenetically distinct races, and scholars now argue that races are cultural interventions reflecting specific attitudes and beliefs that were imposed on different populations in the wake of Western European conquests beginning in the 15th century. But as that definition points out, the word race has a long history of being used to divide members of society, often based on superficial physical attributes. As Brody explains it, for hundreds of years, race has been defined by ourselves, by the law, by scientists, and the government, often with competing interests as cultural norms change. For example, she says, the offensive term mulatto, referring to people of mixed white and black ancestry, used to be freely used in the U.S. Census in the 19th century. Now, not so much. We think we know someone's race when we see it, and it's really much more complicated and more powerful than that, Brody says. They change over time, they have power, and we claim them because they're about our lives, but they're also about our relationship with power. Some people want to exploit difference, and if you want to reclassify people, race is one way of having power over them. How do you define ethnicity? Now, when using the word ethnicity, that term most often refers to the way in which one identifies learned aspects of themselves, i.e., nationality, language, and culture. For example, Italian is both a nationality and an ethnicity. To further clarify, Brody explains that when looking at how it's often used in language, someone could say, I identify as black, but I was raised in Panama, so I'm ethnically Panamanian, or we are both black, but I am West Indian. Or to bring pop culture into it, Jason Momoa identifies his race as Native Hawaiian, but his ethnicity is Polynesian. The U.S. Census's short-sighted way of defining ethnicity is that it determines whether a person is of Hispanic origin or not. So when completing medical or federal paperwork, often your only two options are Hispanic or Latino, and not Hispanic or Latino. Merriam-Webster also offers a vague definition of the word ethnicity, saying it's an ethnic quality or affiliation, a particular ethnic affiliation or group. They then define ethnic as of or relating to large groups of people classed according to common racial, national, tribal, religious, linguistic, or cultural origin or background. When looking at race versus ethnicity, is there a real difference? Brody clarifies that though it seems like they're two different concepts, as explained above, one can't exist without the other, as they have a large influence in how we deal with race in our country. Race and ethnicity are also often substituted for one another due to how an individual chooses to identify and the historical impact on the perception of the two terms. You can't really define them separately because they are intimately related. Sometimes people mistakenly think that ethnicity is reserved only to whites or Europeans, but really it just means one's language or culture, she says. This is why they're kind of interchangeable. There are two ways of understanding. You can think of one, the idea of race earlier in the world and sometimes now, works like ethnicity in terms of one's cultural ideas. So we don't need ethnicity maybe so much or use it as much. The professor points to the history book How the Irish Became White because it shows that the concept of race is something that's made. It delves into how Irish immigrants in the 18th century fled their homeland only to be discriminated against because of their country of origin. But over time, the tides were turned as their skin color, or race, gained them the social acceptance that was denied to African Americans. If you're still confused, here's how Brody puts it to most easily understand. Race is something we believe to be heritable, and ethnicity is something learned. However, this masks the history of how race has been used to create these concepts for political power. Our next article is titled A Reading List for Understanding Race in America. There is a hunger for eye-opening books about race, but where to start? In a list shared exclusively with OpenMag.com, award-winning poet Claudia Rankine offered the books and articles she recommended we read, or reread, to comprehend and process the grief and unrest we experienced nationwide following the killing of George Floyd. Rankine is one of our leading thinkers on race and inequality. She is a poet, essayist, playwright, and Yale professor, as well as MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. Her most recent book, Citizen, won the National Book Critics Circles Award for Poetry in 2015, and concludes with an all-too-prescient line, "Because white men can't police their imagination, Black men are dying. Ranging from literary criticism from Toni Morrison to in-depth looks at the criminal justice system, the following 9 books are starting points for grappling with race's role in shaping American society and in forging a path forward. Number 1, The Fire Next Time by James Baldwin. James Baldwin wrote The Fire Next Time to galvanize readers of all backgrounds to end the racial nightmare, and in doing so, achieve our country and change the history of the world. First published in 1963, The Fire Next Time is often credited with giving a voice to the civil rights movement, but Baldwin's essays about his childhood in Harlem and the urgent need for racial justice are as relevant as ever. A preview. I imagine one of the reasons people cling to their hate so stubbornly is because they sense, once hate is gone, they will be forced to deal with pain. Number 2, We Were 8 Years in Power, An American Tragedy by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Rankin recommended The Case for Reparations, Coates' groundbreaking 2014 essay published in The Atlantic, which argues that giving reparations to descendants of slaves is an idea that should be taken seriously. The essay is included in We Were 8 Years in Power, along with some of Coates' other lauded and incisive writing that reframes modern-day America. A preview. Having been enslaved for 250 years, black people were not left to their own devices. They were terrorized. In the Deep South, a second slavery ruled. Number 3, White Fragility, Why It's So Hard for White People to Talk About Racism by Robin DiAngelo. In this best-selling book, Professor Robin DiAngelo provides white people in North America a manual for confronting racism and interrogates why it's so difficult to do so in the first place. The book is accompanied by a free reader's guide on DiAngelo's website. A preview. It is white people's responsibility to be less fragile. People of color don't need to twist themselves into knots trying to navigate us as painlessly as possible. Number 4, Playing in the Dark, Whiteness and the Literary Imagination by Toni Morrison. With her novels, Toni Morrison wrote about black people for black people. And in this book of essays, Morrison examines how white American authors have shaped black characters on the page and how those portrayals may have perpetuated perceptions of real black people. A preview. There seems to be a more or less tacit agreement among literary scholars that, because American literature has been clearly the preserve of white male views, genius, and power, those views, genius, and power are without relationship to and removed from the overwhelming presence of black people in the United States. Number 5, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander. In The New Jim Crow, legal scholar Michelle Alexander argues that the current criminal justice system is another system of racial control and an inheritor of Jim Crow laws. A preview. Rather than rely on race, we use our criminal justice system to label people of color criminals and then engage in all the practices we supposedly left behind. Today, it is perfectly legal to discriminate against criminals in nearly all the ways that it was once legal to discriminate against African Americans. Number 6, The Wretched of the Earth by Frantz Fanon. The Wretched of the Earth was published in 1961 within the context of colonialism. However, Fanon's verbalization of the psychological effects of oppression hold true today. A preview. Decolonization is truly the creation of new men, but such a creation cannot be attributed to a supernatural power. The thing colonized becomes a man through the very process of liberation. Number 7, Notes of a Native Son by James Baldwin. Written when James Baldwin was in his 20s, Notes on a Native Son is a portrait of black America in the 40s and 50s and a crystallization of the dynamics that have persisted past the era of Jim Crow. A preview. I had to claim my birthright. I am what time, circumstance, history have made of me, certainly, but I am also much more than that. So are we all. Number 8, The History of White People by Nell Irvin Painter. In this 752-page tome, Nell Irwin Painter traces the notion of whiteness through civilizations and how it has been used as a tool to shape U.S. society. A preview. Although science today denies race any standing as objective truth, and the U.S. Census faces taxonomic meltdown, many Americans cling to race as the unschooled cling to superstition. So long as racial discrimination remains a fact of life and statistics can be arranged to support racial difference, the American belief in races will endure. Number 9, they can't kill us all. Ferguson, Baltimore, and a new era in America's racial justice movement by Wesley Lowery. Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery chronicles the uprisings that were a response to Michael Brown's killing by a white police officer in 2014, featuring interviews with Brown's family as well as protest organizers around the country. They Can't Kill Us All situates the killing of George Floyd within a grim history. A preview. Ferguson would birth a movement and set the nation on a course for a still ongoing public hearing on race that stretched far past the killing of unarmed residents. From daily policing to Confederate imagery, to respectability politics, to cultural appropriation. The social justice movement spawned from Mike Brown's blood would force city after city to grapple with its own fraught histories of race and policing. Our next article by Martha Beck is titled, Six Steps to Regret-Proof Your Life. So here's the story. After a lifetime of hand-copying ancient texts, an elderly monk became abbot of his monastery. Realizing that for centuries his order had been making copies of copies, he decided to examine some of the monastery's original documents. Days later, the other monks found him in the cellar weeping over a crumbling manuscript and moaning, "It says celebrate, not celibate." Ah, regret. The forehead slap of hindsight, the woeful fuel of country ballads, the self-recrimination I feel for eating a quart of pudding in a crafty but unsuccessful attempt to avoid writing this column. If you've ever made a bad decision or suffered an accident, regret has been your roommate, if not your conjoined twin. It's a difficult companion, prone to accusatory comments and dark moods, and it changes you, leaving you both tougher and more tender. You get to decide, however, whether your toughness will look like unreachable bitterness or unstoppable resilience. Your tenderness, the raw vulnerability of a never-healing wound, or a kindness so deep it heals every wound it touches. Regret can be your worst enemy or your best friend. You get to decide which. There are at least two time zones where you can choose to make regret's powerful energy healing rather than destructive: the past and the future. Both can be transformed by what you decide to do right now in this moment. Let's start by changing the past. If you think that can't be done, think again, literally. The past doesn't exist except as a memory, a mental story, and though past events aren't changeable, your stories about them are. You can act now to transform the way you tell the story of your past, ultimately making it a stalwart protector of your future. Try these steps more or less in order. Number 1, get beyond denial. As long as you're thinking that shouldn't have happened or I shouldn't have done that, you're locked in a struggle against reality. Many people pour years of energy into useless shouldn't haves. The angry ones endlessly repeat that their ex-spouses shouldn't have left them, their parents shouldn't have overfed them, or their bosses shouldn't have made them wear uncomfortable chipmunk costumes in 90-degree heat. Even drearier are the sad ones who forever drone some version of if only. If only they'd married Sebastian or gotten that promotion or heeded the label's advice not to operate heavy machinery, they would be happy campers instead of Les Miserables. Number 2, separate regret's basic ingredients. Of the four basic emotions, sad, mad, glad, and scared, regret is a mixture of the first two. Your particular situation may involve enormous sadness and a little anger. My father died before I ever met him. Damn cruel fate. Or enormous anger with a side of sadness. Why did I get a haircut from a stylist who was actively smoking a bong? Whatever the proportions, some regretters feel sadness but resist feeling anger. Others acknowledge outrage but not sorrow. Denying either component will get you stuck in bitter, unproductive regret. When you've fully itemized your sadness, make another list, beginning each sentence with the phrase, "I'm angry at blank." For example, "I'm angry at my body for being sick." "I'm angry at God for creating ticks." "I'm angry at the entire town of Lyme, Connecticut, for which this shit disease was named." Write down all the causes for your rage, even if they're irrational. Number 3, grieve what is irrevocably lost. You're finished grieving when you see someone gaining what you regret losing and feel only joy for them, maybe even secret gratitude that circumstances forced you to enlarge your own capacity for joy. This is how I feel about people who don't have a kid with Down syndrome. If your sadness stops evaporating, if a certain amount of it just isn't budging, simply grieving may not be enough. Regret is telling you to seek out a part of whatever you've lost. Jenny's big regret was that one disastrous gymnastics meet had tanked her chances to make the Olympic team. When I asked her what she would have gotten from the Olympics, she said pride, excitement, world-class competition, attention. Once she'd articulated these essentials, Jenny found herself gravitating toward a job in television, which provided all of them. Now she says her life is so exciting that she virtually never thinks about the Olympics. Instead of sidelining her, regret became just one more springboard. I call this unproductive regret. People use it to avoid scary or difficult action. Instead of telling the story of the past in a useful way, they use it as their excuse for staying wretched. If you're prone to unproductive regret, please hear this. Everyone agrees with you. That thing you regret, it really, really, really shouldn't have happened. But it did. If you enjoy being miserable, by all means, continue to rail against this fact. If you'd rather be happy, prune the shouldn't-haves from your mental story and move on. Considering anger and sadness separately makes both more useful. Right now, think of something you regret. With that something in mind, finish this sentence. I'm sad that blank. Repeat until you run out of sad things related to that particular regret. For example, if your regret is contracting Lyme disease, you might say, I'm sad that I feel awful. I'm sad I can no longer ride my pogo stick. I'm sad that the woods don't feel safe to me anymore. Once you have a clear list of your sorrows and outrages, you can move on to step 3, where you work both angles to transform unproductive regret into the productive kind. This is extraordinarily useful, but also profoundly uncomfortable, because the only way out of painful emotion is through. Sorrow is a natural reaction to losing anything significant, a dream, a possession, an opportunity. Productive grief passes through you in waves, which feel horrific, but which steadily erode your sadness. The crushing mountain of sorrow eventually becomes a boulder on your back, then a rock in your pocket, then a pebble in your shoe, then nothing at all. Not because circumstances change, but because you become strong enough to handle reality with ease. Number 4, reclaim the essence of your dreams. You can't change the fact that you binged your way up to 300 pounds, or lost a winning lottery ticket, or spent decades in celibacy rather than celebration. But you can reclaim the essential experiences you missed. Loving your own healthy body, enjoying abundance, feeling glorious passion. In this moment, resolve that you'll find ways to reclaim the essence of anything you can't stop grieving. I've been coaching long enough to brazenly promise that if you decide to reclaim the essence of anything you regret losing, you'll find it, often sooner than you think, in ways you would never have expected. Number 5, analyze your anger. The anger component of regret is every bit as important and useful as your sadness. Anger is a bear, but if you pay attention, you'll hear it roaring useful instructions about how you should steer your future. Don't fear it, run from it, tranquilize it, or try to kill it. Just leave the kids with a sitter, team up with a sympathetic friend, spouse, therapist, or journal, and let your angry animal self-bellow its messages. There will be a lot of meaningless sound and fury, but there will also be information about exactly what needs to change in your present and future so that you'll stop suffering from old regrets and create new ones. Basically, your anger will roar out this next instruction. Number 6, learn to lean loveward. When I saw a chorus line, I wondered if it's literally true that I can't regret what I did for love. So I did a little thought experiment. I recalled all my significant regrets, and sure enough, I found that none of them followed a choice based purely on love. all were the consequences of fear-based decisions. In the cases where my motivations were a mix of love and fear, it was always the fear-based component that left me fretful and regretful. For example, I'll be up most of tonight having spent the daylight hours eating pudding in reaction to writer's block, which is a species of fear. I predict that tomorrow I'll regret this. I've spent many, many sleepless nights fearing this or that, and no good ever came of it. But I've also lost a lot of sleep for love. I've stayed up communing with friends, rocking sick babies, avoiding celibacy. And I really can't regret any choice that brought me one moment of love. Do your own thought experiment, and I suspect you'll come to similar conclusions. Let's face it, a song that catchy just can't be all wrong. So the ultimate lesson of regret, the one that will help guide you into a rich and satisfying future, is this. Every time life brings you to a crossroads, from the tiniest to the most immense, go toward love, not away from fear. Think of every choice in terms of what would thrill and delight me, rather than what will keep my fear or the events, people, and things I fear at bay. Sometimes the choice will be utterly clear. Love steers you forward and no fear arises. But on many occasions, things will seem trickier. The path toward what you love may be fraught with uneasiness, anxiety, or outright terror. The dog at the pound will tug at your heart, but worry about upkeep will push away the first sparks of love and leave you without a four-footed friend. You'll long for success, but dread the risks necessary to earn it. Your impulse to champion the oppressed might compete with panic for your own sorry hide. That's when you can call in regret, not as a burden that you still have to bear, but as a motivator that can forcefully remind you not to make choices that will feel awful in retrospect. If you've grieved your losses, reclaimed your dreams, and articulated your anger, regret will have made you the right kind of tough and tender. Dauntless of spirit, soft of heart, convinced by experience that nothing based on fear, but everything based on love, is worth doing. Living this way doesn't guarantee an easy life. In fact, it will probably take you on a wondrously wild ride. But I promise you won't regret it. Martha Beck is the best-selling author of The Way of Integrity and host of the podcast Bewildered. Our next article by Penny Musco is titled, Yes, I'm Bald. No, I Don't Have Cancer. The first time I showed off my bald head in public, I took a trip to the grocery store. As I walked down aisles filled with pre-made cookies and cakes and jams and jellies, I expected that my fellow shoppers might do double takes and stare less subtly, which, sure enough, they did. I even anticipated that some strangers, especially those agonizing over their own thinning hair, might ask me outright about my baldness, which, again, they did. What I wasn't prepared for? The number of people who assume that because I'm bald, I must have cancer. The first time that happened was at the gym. An older man came up to me and said, I think it's great you're working out. I didn't know how to respond, so I thanked him, praying that he'd leave it at that and go away. No such luck, though. Are you undergoing chemo? It was time for the truth. No, I actually have severe hair loss. Oh, he said, and took a moment to recover, then added, well, I think you're very brave to walk around like that. Wait a minute, I thought. Was he inadvertently saying that I looked awful? And more importantly, what's this about being brave? That notion had never crossed my mind. Not really, I replied. I'm just fed up. By that point, I'd been losing my hair for well over a decade. In 2009, I noticed that my forehead seemed to be growing larger and larger, so I made an appointment with a doctor who confirmed that my hairline was receding, and to my surprise, had been for quite some time. That kicked off a years-long quest involving more doctors, lots of tests, many so-called treatments, and finally a diagnosis. As it turns out, I have not one, but two kinds of alopecia. The first attacks hair all over my head and body. The other specifically targets my front hairline, and both destroy the hair follicles, resulting in scarring and permanent hair loss. The bottom line? It wasn't that my hair follicles weren't working right, as I had been told previously. They were dying and would not be coming back. An autoimmune disease, doctors concluded, not life-threatening, merely devastating. Up until I started losing my hair, I was never overly obsessed with it, in part because I had taken its existence for granted. During my younger years, my blonde hair was long, lush, and super straight. In fact, there were at least a few cuts where the stylist used trimming shears to remove some of the excess bulk, which now is pretty ironic. As I got older, I experimented with shorter styles, as well as high and low lights, before landing on a sleek chin-length bob. But now, with a hairless head on the horizon, I was desperate to hold on to each and every strand. I downed prescription medications and over-the-counter supplements. I tried all sorts of creams, lotions, and potions. I endured steroid shots in my scalp, which, yes, are as painful as they sound. I even contemplated a transplant in which healthy strands from the then-adequate supply at the base of my scalp would be harvested and relocated to thinner and more barren spots. But the cost was steep, anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000, especially given that it was as likely not to work as it was. As my hair continued its slow exodus, my strategy shifted from styling tricks and techniques, think root touch-up sprays and incredibly flattering cut, to wearing lots of hats and eventually wigs. When I could no longer hide my increasingly sparse eyebrows, I investigated stick-on brows made from human hair, too fake-looking. Considered microblading, $500 annually? I wish. And auditioned a wide variety of pencils. Finally, I got to a point where, for the most part, I stopped crying over my disappearing hair and accepted my wig-filled fate. That is, until a few years ago, when a walk on the beach changed everything. As my husband and I strolled along the shore, he pointed out a woman with a blonde buzz cut. Whether her closely cropped cut was a choice or a solution to her own hair loss, I don't know. But she seemed unapologetic about her style, which was something I hadn't felt for years. It was the first time I imagined a life without hair, and it didn't wig me out. I asked my husband, "You think I should get that?" "You'd look great," he replied immediately. So when he took off on a long bike ride the next day, I grabbed my purse and drove to the nearest salon. "I want a buzz cut," I said as soon as I plopped down in the stylist's chair. "You sure?" she asked. "Yes," I answered firmly. "What length?" As if I'd ever done this in my 60-plus years here on Earth. "I don't know. Short?" "Do you plan to wear a wig?" "On occasion. I also have hats, but I was thinking I'd just..." She smiled broadly. "Rock it?" With that, she picked up her clippers and got to work, cutting my remaining hair super short and in doing so revealing all the bare patches I'd spent so much time and energy trying to hide. I wouldn't end up looking exactly like the woman at the beach, but it didn't matter. I had crossed a threshold. I was done hiding. And it felt terrific. As the hairdresser handed me a mirror so I could inspect the back, she made a prediction. "I'm guessing that the next time you're here, you'll want to take it all off." She was right, though it happened much sooner than she had expected. A few days later, I asked my husband, "Do you think I should get rid of it altogether?" "If you want." I had to ask, no matter how ridiculous it seemed. "You'd still love me with no hair?" He shot me a look that said, "Seriously? After all these years, you think my love depends on your hair?" Then he went into research mode, comparing all the reviews and ratings to find the best pair of clippers on the market. When it arrived, we crowded in front of our bathroom mirror and did it ourselves. And I loved it. The same could not be said of my 94-year-old mother. "What have you done to your hair?" she asked when she first saw my new look. "It looks terrible." But her blunt words didn't bother me. Most of my friends and family have responded to my shining bald glory with a shrug and even some playful teasing. "The Bible says God numbers the hairs on our heads," one quipped. "You've just made it easier for him." When my husband texted a photo to our daughter, she wrote back in true millennial fashion, "Good for her. She's not afraid to try something new." While that's true, I'd be lying if I said that encounters like that one at the gym didn't bother me, particularly when the well wishes and words of encouragement come from women who've been through chemo. When I explain I have alopecia, they're almost always taken aback and embarrassed to have gotten it wrong. Yet they're the ones with a serious illness. All I have is hair loss. I'll take some sympathy, but not that much. Now, don't get me wrong, I know my encouragers are well-intentioned. But in those early days, I couldn't help but wonder if I had brought this on myself, especially given that baldness is a common side effect of cancer treatment. I thought, is this what I get for defying society's norms and expectations? Pretty soon, though, I've stopped asking myself these questions because the truth is I'm not in charge of people's mistaken impressions. In fact, years ago, I came across this saying in an advice column. At 20, you care what everyone thinks of you. At 40, you don't care what anyone thinks of you. And at 60, you realize they haven't been thinking about you at all. There's a lot of truth in that, except for the fact that bald-headed females, no matter how we got that way, are rare, and hairless women my age are even scarcer, so I'm pretty confident that they have been thinking about us after all. But in my seventh decade, I finally learned what I should have 2 decades earlier. They can think what they like, but this is who I am now, and I'm just fine with that. We'll end this week with a message from Oprah honoring the courage of the Ukrainian people. Courage is the most important of all the virtues, Maya Angelou would often say to me, because without it, no other virtue can be practiced consistently. The courage of the Ukrainian people has lit a fire within people all over the world, count me among them. United as one to resist subjugation by Russia through any means necessary, their living, breathing example stands as a profound wake-up call to all of us. We must not take our democracy for granted. President Volodymyr Zelensky, a former actor who until recently was known as Ukraine's accidental president, has left more experienced peers everywhere in awe. A fiery speech he delivered to European Parliament brought many in the audience, among them his translator, near tears. He has not only risen to the occasion, but has united the world around his country's cause and shown us what true inspirational leadership looks like. Heroes are everywhere, from people like Chef Jose Andreas, whose World Central Kitchen moved quickly to serve freezing refugees hot tea and chicken soup at the Ukraine-Poland borders, to business and government leaders who have put aside their financial and political interests to rally around Ukraine and isolate Putin and Russia. And on the ground in Ukraine, volunteers pour in from all over to take up arms alongside their Ukrainian brothers and sisters. What we're witnessing in Ukraine and in the world's response to it is what we can do when we connect, when we allow ourselves to imagine what another might be feeling. We are witnessing something truly powerful, and it may be the light under the fire we need to fight for each other instead of fighting one another. To remember that our democracy is something we have to work on and fight for each and every day. Already many lives have been lost and families separated, and doubtless there are dark days to come. But if courage is the most important virtue, and like Maya, I believe it is, then the Ukrainian people are giving us a big lesson in how to act courageously, and now we need to ensure that those lessons endure every day forward. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.